eagerly offered him up. With great effort he clutched his long black coat around his neck and stepped into the cold Moscow night. The bite of the cold wind snatched at his ears and cheeks. His eyes filled with tears, and he could have sworn the hair in his nose had turned to icicles in under a second. He opened his mouth narrowly to catch a breath, but his teeth ached from the sub-zero temperature, so he lowered his head and shuffled toward the car. He'd learned that the hard way on the last trip. You never ran on a Moscow sidewalk in winter. No matter how cold it was, you shuffled, half skating, half walking. It wasn't until he was in the back seat that he realized he was sitting in a brand new Range Rover. Apparently, capitalism had been very good to the SVR, the KGB's bastard offspring. The man who had fetched him from the gate tossed Syed's suitcase in back and jumped in the front passenger seat. "I take it you don't like the cold?" a voice asked, in decent yet accented English. Syed had his head shoved so far down into his jacket that he hadn't noticed the diminutive man sitting next to him. "How do you people live here?" The man smiled, popped a shiny cigarette case, and offered one to his guest. Syed grabbed one. Anything that would provide a scintilla of warmth was to be taken advantage of. After he'd taken a few long drags and had stopped shivering, Syed sat back and said, "I do not think we have met before."
"No, we have not. I am Nikolai Shvets."
Syed offered his hand. "I am Asif."
"I know,"
the boyish-looking man replied with a smile.
"I take it you work for Mikhail?"
"Yes. The deputy director is a very busy man. He will be joining us later."
That was fine by Syed. Mikhail Ivanov, the deputy director of Directorate S, was not someone he looked forward to dealing with. Syed had done everything in his power to get out of the trip and then to delay it when he was told he had no choice. 2 days ago, Ivanov had called his boss at the General Security Directorate in Damascus and told General Hamoud he would consider it a personal insult if Asif Syed was not in Moscow by week's end. The last the general had heard, the meeting had already been scheduled. He was not a happy man, and he made sure Syed understood just how unhappy he was.
"The deputy director is very much looking forward to speaking with you. He has been talking about it for some time."
Syed couldn't pretend happiness over seeing the old spider, so he said,
"It's too bad you did not travel to Damascus. It is very nice there this time of year."
"I would imagine."
The man glanced over his shoulder and looked out the back window.
"Your Mediterranean blood is too thin for our Moscow winters."
The boy man made idle conversation as they worked their way around one of the ring roads that circled the big metropolis. Syed barely glanced out the window, even though it was his habit to be constantly alert for surveillance. It wouldn't matter in this iceberg of a city at this time of night. Streetlights and headlights were amplified by the white snow, blinding him every time he tried to see where they were. This truly was a miserable place. No wonder communism had failed. How could any form of government succeed if everyone was depressed? They finally stopped in front of a hotel in the heart of old Moscow. A doorman in a massive black fur hat and red wool coat with two rows of shiny brass buttons yanked open the door, and Syed felt a blast of cold air hit his ankles. With a second doorman shuffling along with him, he walked through the front door of the hotel and did not stop. Cold air was still whistling through the doors, and he wanted to get as far away from it as possible. 8 steps into the lobby, he found himself drawn in the direction of heat and then finally spied a roaring fire on the far side of the lobby. He actually smiled and shuffled over, his brain, not realizing the lobby, was ice-free.
"What do you think?"
Syed parked his backside directly in front of the flames. He took in the opulent lobby and nodded. It was much nicer than the dump he had stayed in the last time he was here.
"Very nice."
"It has just reopened. It is Hotel Balchug. Very historic. Very expensive."
Shvets left out the fact that his boss owned a piece of the hotel. He owned a piece of most things in Moscow these days. At least the nice things. A group of Russian, Austrian, and Swiss businessmen had purchased the hotel just after the collapse and had tried to renovate. After a year of getting turned down for permits and dealing with theft and workers not showing up, one of the Russians went to Ivanov for help. The problems disappeared almost overnight. All they had to do in return was sign over 10% of the hotel. Syed did not want to leave the fire, but he had to get ready for dinner. He was finally convinced to move when they informed him that his room had two fireplaces that were both lit and waiting for him. The room was as nice as the lobby, with gilded plaster and hand-painted murals on the ceiling, tapestries on the walls, and a commanding view of the Kremlin and Red Square. It was fit for a pasha. That was when it hit him. Ivanov the Spider never did anything nice, unless he wanted something in return. And he was being extremely nice. Syed took a steaming hot shower and wondered what the man was after. He'd heard stories lately that the SVR was worse than the KGB, that once they sank their talons into you, they owned you for the rest of your life. He suddenly longed for the bombed-out rubble of Beirut. There he was a lion. Here, he could end up being someone's lunch. Chapter 29. Syed had just one wool suit. It was black and was worn for special occasions. He was wearing it tonight because it was his warmest suit, and also because to a man like Ivanov, appearances were exceedingly important. He lectured his people about taking care of themselves, and was known for firing people who put on too much weight, or women who wore too much or too little makeup. Syed had carefully trimmed his beard and slicked his black hair back behind his ears. At 40 he was still in decent shape, or at least he wasn't out of shape. The black suit and white shirt and tie helped hide those few extra pounds he'd put on over the last couple of years. As he walked toward the restaurant, he immediately picked out the men from Ivanov's security detail. There were four in the lobby, one by the front door, one by the elevators, and two bracketing the entrance to the restaurant. The boy man suddenly appeared from behind a large plant. His cigarette was hanging from the side of his mouth, and he was smiling. Syed had been in such a rush to avoid the cold earlier that he had failed to notice that Nikolai was extremely handsome. More pretty, really, in kind of a movie star way. There were none of the usual rough edges that were standard with the lackeys in the Russian state security services. His skin was fair, his eyes a greenish-blue, and his hair a light enough brown that he would probably be blonde if he lived in a warmer climate. "Your room is nice? Yes?" Shvets asked. "Very." Shvets popped his cigarette case with one hand and offered one to his guest. Syed took one as well as a light. "Director Ivanov is waiting for you at your table. I hope you are hungry." "Yes, very much so. It is the cold weather. Please follow me." The restaurant was decorated in deep reds and sparkling golds, most of it in velvet. It was typical Russian, heavy-handed and desperate to impress. This backwater behemoth knew nothing of understated class. Syed was no snob, but he was proud of where he came from. The Ottoman Empire had lasted for more than 600 years. After fewer than 100 years, these brutes had gone from one of two superpowers to a mob state. A haze of blue-gray smoke hung in the air. Every table was occupied. There were easily several hundred people in the restaurant, and they all appeared to be in various states of inebriation. It occurred to Syed for the first time that the Russians were loud people, especially when they laughed. Syed didn't recognize any faces, but he guessed they were all very important. That was the Russian way, even during the height of the great workers' paradise. The ruling elite had lived an opulent life separate from the workers. They enjoyed luxuries that the little people never dreamed of. Two towering men stood watch near a booth in the back corner. Red velvet curtains were pulled open and fastened with tasseled ropes to marble columns. Syed glimpsed Ivanov sitting between two young beauties. The man was nearing 60 and was showing no signs of slowing down. He was a consumer of all things that interested him. In a way, he was the perfect man to run an intelligence service, assuming his interests were in line with those of the state. Syed had been told that Ivanov's power had grown significantly in recent years. In the days of the Politburo, the black market was tolerated but never flaunted. During the transfer from centrally controlled markets and government plans to pseudo-capitalism, no one was better positioned to take advantage of the new wealth than the men at the KGB. They had the guns, the enforcers, and the spycraft to break, blackmail, or frame any man who did not welcome them to the buffet. And Ivanov had an insatiable appetite.
Ivanov saw him coming and yelled his name. He tried to stand but was stuck between the two girls, so he gave up and sat back down.
"Asef, it is good to see you."
The Russian threw out a large hand with rings on the forefinger and pinky.
"And you too, Mikhail,"
Syed lied. He reached across the table and clasped Ivanov's hand.
"If you had turned me down one more time, I was going to send my men after you,"
Ivanov said with a hearty laugh, although his eyes weren't smiling. Syed laughed and tried to play along. The comment was without a doubt meant for him to remember, and keep remembering every time Ivanov called on him. Syed so badly wanted this evening to end, and it had only just begun. Ivanov ordered an expensive bottle of Bordeaux and introduced Syed to the girls. The blonde one was Alisa, and the redhead was Svetlana. The redhead was suddenly very interested in the spy from Syria. That was how Ivanov had introduced him, as a spy, of all things. The Russians might have found the moniker intriguing, but to Syed it was an insult. One of many he was sure he would be forced to endure on this cold winter evening. More wine was ordered, along with plate after plate of food. Syed was full by the time the main course was served. Ivanov steered the conversation away from anything serious, and Svetlana steered her hands toward Syed's groin. Syed had no illusions about his ability to woo women. He was handsome enough, but not enough to garner the attention of a 20-year-old runway model. Ivanov had undoubtedly ordered her to take care of him. Syed wondered if she would be beaten after he turned her down. When the plates were cleared, Ivanov nudged Alisa out of the booth and ordered Svetlana to follow. He told the girls to go to the bar and order dessert. As they walked away, he slapped each girl on the ass. They turned around, one giving him a dirty look, the other pouting. Ivanov laughed at them and watched them hold hands all the way to the bar, and then, as if a switch had been flicked, he turned all business. After whispering something in one of his bodyguard's ears, he plopped back into the booth and moved around so that he was sitting a mere foot from Syed. The drapes were pulled shut, and they were alone. "You have been avoiding me." He'd said it with a crooked smile, but that menacing glint in his eye was back. Syed deflected by saying, "I do not enjoy travel, and the cold weather is something my body is not used to. I meant no offense."
"Ah, I know what you mean. In the summer I find Damascus to be unbearable. But don't worry, I wasn't offended,"
Ivanov said, lying to himself more than Syed.
"I just wish it hadn't taken this long. We have many important things to discuss."
"Yes, I know," Syed said, trying to be agreeable. Ivanov took a gulp of wine and asked,
"How long have we known each other?"
"A long time," Syed said, looking into his own glass. 12 years, I think."
13, actually. And we have fucked with the Americans like no one else."
Ivanov made a fist and shook it.
"Every time they have tried to stick their nose in your business, we have sent them running away like a scared dog."
"That is true," Syed said, making no mention of all the times the Russians had stuck their long snouts into his business.
"And now they are back again."
Syed was still looking at the expensive French wine in his glass. He could feel Ivanov watching him with intensity. He shrugged and said,
"Not really. That is not what I have heard."
"What have you heard?"
"I have heard you captured one of Langley's deep cover operatives."
Syed's mind was swimming with thoughts of murder. The idiots in Damascus, no doubt, had passed the information to the Russian. Did anyone in his government know how to keep a secret? Knowing he was trapped, he said, "We caught one of them snooping around. I'm not sure he was an agent of any particular importance." Ivanov smiled.
"I think you are being modest."
Syed didn't know how to answer, so he took a drink of wine.
"I am told this man worked in the Directorate of Operations, that he reported directly to Deputy Director Stansfield, that he worked in Berlin and Moscow for a time."
Someone in Damascus really did have a big mouth. "As you know from experience, these men are trained to lie. I cannot say with any certainty that his claims are truthful.
They usually try to understate their importance, not overstate it."
"That was true. The important thing is that we have bloodied them yet again, and as you know, they do not have the stomach for this kind of thing. Ivanov gave him a dubious look.
I'm not so sure these days.
Syed was. Do not worry yourself with such a little fish.
This might be a bigger fish than you think,
Ivanov said, with a hint of inside knowledge.
What have you heard? Things, rumors here and there, nothing concrete, but I've been in this business long enough to smell a rat.
What things?
Hamdi Sharif.
Syed thought of the recently deceased arms dealer. Yes, I knew him well.
Who do you think killed him?
Syed had heard two rumors. Mossad, more than likely. But there was something else I picked up.
What?
Syed was not afraid to repeat the rumor. A man like Ivanov would take it as a compliment. That he was stealing from you, and you had him killed. Ivanov looked at him with unblinking focus, but did not respond. If that was the case, Syed said, then that was your right. Ivanov shook his head.
If he was stealing from me, I would have known, and I would have killed him. But he was not stealing from me.
So it was the Jews?
No, I don't think so.
Who then? Ivanov sat brooding for a half minute and finally said,
I would like to speak to the American rat you are keeping in that basement in Beirut.
He had not told a soul in Damascus where he was keeping the CIA man, which meant either that Ivanov had obtained the information from one of Syed's supposed allies, or that it was a good guess. Whichever was the case, he would need to move the American as soon as he got back. You are more than welcome to speak to him. You are welcome in Beirut any time, you know that. Ivanov began shaking his head at the mention of Beirut.
I cannot. There are far too many things happening here in Moscow. Things that need my urgent attention.
Syed tried to deflect by saying,
So you think the Americans are trying to get back in the game?
I don't think so.
I know so.
Syed looked skeptical.
How? Because Thomas Stansfield is finally in charge of their clandestine activities.
You think one man is capable of turning that mess around? They don't have the stomach to get back into Lebanon. This man I caught...
Ivanov pounded his fist on the table, cutting him off. Let me tell you something about Thomas Stansfield. I had to go up against him early in my career. The man plots on more levels than you or I are capable of comprehending. He is a master of deception operations. He gets you running around like a dog chasing your tail.
Ivanov circled his hand around his wine glass faster and faster.
You become obsessed with traitors in your midst, and you forget to do your job. You see shadows everywhere you turn, and you become completely defensive, and that is just one facet of the man. There is another side, where he is more Russian than American.
Syed had no idea what he meant.
More Russian than American? He is the last of a breed of Americans who knew how to be every bit as dirty as the dirtiest enemy. Don't let his grandfatherly image deceive you. The man is a street fighter with a big set of Russian balls.
Syed wasn't sure why the man's balls were Russian. Beyond that, he thought Ivanov was overreacting.
The Americans haven't bitten back in years, Syed scoffed. I know. And that was because we had the CIA in a box. And Stansfield didn't have the power. But he is in charge of their clandestine service now, and I'm telling you, he is going to stick his nose in our business, and we can't allow that to happen. Trust me, if he gets so much as a toehold, we will be in for the fight of our lives.
Syed still wasn't convinced. Ivanov leaned forward, then grabbed the Syrian's hand.
I am asking you this one time. I will only ask it once. Will you give me the American so I can find out what he knows? I know your Iranian friends want him, but I will make sure you are compensated.
This was why Syed did not want to come to this godless frozen city. There was nothing in it for him, especially since he was not done dissecting the mind of Agent John Cummins. Unfortunately, There was no way out. If he did not bend to Ivanov's wishes, he might not make it out of the country in one piece. With a heavy sigh, he told Ivanov that he could have the American. Chapter 30. Hamburg, Germany. The Hamburg operation was significant for a number of reasons, not the least of which was that certain people began to take notice. A single murder can be an accident or an aberration. Two murders in as many weeks, separated by time but connected by relationships, is a tough one to swallow for people whose job it is to be paranoid. The second reason it was significant was that Rapp finally realized Stan Hurley was extremely good at what he did. Hurley had given them 5 days to get their affairs in order. They were going on the road and would not be coming back to the States for several months. The old clandestine officer announced with a gleam in his eye, "We've been kicked out of the office by management. They don't want to see us back in Washington until we have some results to show for all the money and time that's been spent on your sorry asses." Rapp was not given all the details, but he got the distinct impression that Langley was upset about something. Hurley's attitude had changed even before they left the States. They were to engage the enemy and make them bleed, and the prospect of finally getting back in the game had transformed Hurley. This time Rapp and Richards went in together, or at least their flights arrived the same afternoon. Rapp arrived second. He saw Richards waiting for him on the other side of customs. Rapp was carrying an American passport on his trip, and he handed it to a nice-looking older gentleman who flipped through the pages with German efficiency. The backpack, jeans, and beat-up wool coat must have been enough to tell the man he was not here on business, because he didn't ask that standard question, business or pleasure. He applied the proper stamps and slid the passport back. Not a glance or a question. Rapp laughed to himself. If only it was always this easy. The two men shook hands and made their way to ground transportation, where they took a cab to the harbor promenade, or Landungsbrücken, as it was known to the locals. A big cruise ship was coming into port. Tourists lined the sidewalk, gawking at the massive ship that looked completely out of place so close to all the old brick buildings. Rapp and Richards did not gawk. They were on the move toward the warehouse district, where Hurley was waiting for them. They passed a prostitute working the riverfront. Richards turned to Rapp and said, "Isn't this where the Beatles got their start?" Rapp cracked a small smile. He liked Richards. The guy was quirky in a normal way. They were in Hamburg to kill a man, and Richards wanted to talk about the Beatles. "Never heard that," Rapp said. "Pretty sure they did. They played some strip club for something like 2 months straight." Rapp didn't say anything. "I'd like to see it while we're here." Rapp cocked his head and gave Richards a long look before he couldn't help himself and started laughing. "What?" Richards asked. Rapp lowered his voice and said, "We're here to kill a man, and you want to go hang out at some strip club where the Beatles played 30 years ago?
"What's wrong with that?"
"That we do what we do for a living doesn't mean we can't do what normal people do." Richards had a much easier time transitioning between their two worlds. "You have a point. I can't wait to see the look on Stan's face when you ask him."
"Ah, you watch. If it involves booze and strippers, my bet is he's all in."
"You're probably right." The flat was located in one of the 100-year-old warehouses that had been converted into condominiums near the river. It was damp and cold, a lot like London. Hurley informed them that the majority of the units in the building were as yet unsold. The one they were using was owned by an American company that had purchased it as an executive apartment. Rapp didn't concern himself with certain details beyond the target, but Richards was more curious. He tried to find out which American company the unit belonged to, and if it was a former spook who let them use it. Hurley said if there was something he needed to know, he'd tell him.
"Otherwise, don't worry about it."
Rapp and Hurley hadn't exactly made peace. It was more of a truce. After the night he'd met George, or whatever his real name was, Rapp, Richards, and Hurley had gone back down to the lake house to begin prepping for the Hamburg operation. Hurley, from time to time, still looked at Rapp as if he were mentally retarded, but he had cut back on his yelling and cussing. Rapp took this as a sign of détente. After 5 days, Hurley asked Rapp to take a walk.
"Have you gone over the last op in your head?"
"You mean Istanbul?"
"How many ops have you been on?"
Hurley asked him, with a wake-up expression on his face. Sorry, Rapp said. Yeah, I've thought about it.
Anything you would have done different?
Rapp stared at the ground while they talked. I'm not sure I know what you mean.
The fact that you acted on your own is behind us. I already told you that. Part of my job is to make sure you get better. What I'm asking you is a tactical question. When you look back on what happened in the park that morning, once you decided to kill him, is there anything that you would have done different?
I don't know, Rapp answered honestly. It all just kind of happened. Hurley nodded, having been there before.
That's good and bad, kid. It might be that you're a natural at this, ice in your veins, that kind of shit, or you got lucky. Only time will tell, but there's one thing you did that jumps out as being pretty stupid.
What's that? Rapp asked. Hurley had his full attention.
I read the police report.
Rapp didn't know why he was surprised, but he was.
The shot to the heart, it was point blank. Literally. The report was conclusive. The muzzle of the weapon was in direct contact with Sharif's coat.
Rapp nodded. He was there. He remembered it well.
Why would you do that?
Because I wanted to kill him. Hurley stopped and faced him.
Kid, I've seen you shoot. You're not as good as me, but you're damn good, and you keep getting better. You don't think you could have popped him from, say, 10 feet?
Rapp didn't answer.
Why did you sit down next to him?
I'm not sure.
Bullshit, Hurley said with a smile. You allowed it to get personal, didn't you?
Rapp thought back to that morning, not even a week ago. The feeling came back, that split-second decision to sit next to Sharif so he could look into his eyes. He slowly nodded.
Yeah, I guess I did.
Hurley's jaw tightened while he processed the admission.
I'm not going to stand here and tell you there haven't been times that I took a certain amount of joy in sending some of these scumbags to paradise. But you have to be really careful. Pick the right environment. Never in public like you did. He could have had a gun. Somebody could have seen you sitting next to him. A lot of things could have gone wrong.
I know.
Remember, in public, the key is to look natural. That's why I showed you the shoulder holster technique. That's why we practice it. You look at your watch, and no one thinks twice about it. You're a guy checking the time. You sit down on a park bench that close to another guy, and someone might notice. Just enough to cause him to look twice, and that's all it might take. The next thing you know, the carabinieri are chasing you down the street shooting at you.
Hurley gave him a dead serious look.
Trust me, I've been there.
Hurley shuddered at the memory.
What?
Rapp asked.
You ever been to Venice?
Yeah.
The canals.
Hurley made a diving motion with his hands.
You dove into one of those canals?
Rapp asked, while recalling their putrid shade of green.
And this was 30 years ago. They're a lot cleaner now than they were back then.
The condo was raw, exposed brick with heavy timber beams secured to each other by sturdy iron brackets with big bolts. The floors were wide plank, more than likely pine, stained light to add a little brightness in contrast to the dark mud-red bricks. The furniture was utilitarian, grays and blues, wood and metal frames, long sleek lines, and the kind of fabrics that could be cleaned. Pure bachelor efficiency. It was a corner unit, so it had two small balconies, one off the master bedroom and another off the living room. There was a second bedroom and a loft space with a desk and pull-out couch. When they arrived, Hurley had everything prepared. The dining room table was covered with a sheet. Hurley carefully pulled it back to reveal what he'd pieced together in 3 short days. The target was a banker by the name of Hans Dorfman. He looked innocent enough, but then again, to Rapp, most bankers did. Dorfman's crime, as Hurley stated it, was that he'd decided to get into bed with the wrong people.
You're probably wondering, Hurley asked, why a well-educated man who was raised a Christian would decide to help a bunch of Islamic whack jobs wage terrorism.
Richards looked down at a black-and-white photo of the 63-year-old banker and said,
Yep. Well, officially, it's none of your goddamn business. When we're given an assignment, it's not our place to question, right?
Both Rapp and Richards gave half-hearted nods.
Wrong, Hurley said.
I don't care what anyone tells you, HQ can fuck up, and they can fuck up big time. Beyond that, you'll run into the occasional Yahoo who doesn't have a clue how things work in the real world. When you get a kill assignment, you'd better question it, and you'd better be damn careful. We don't do collateral damage. Women and children are strictly off-limits.
Rapid heard this countless times from Hurley and the other instructors. But people make mistakes.
They do, he agreed. And the more difficult the job, the greater the chance that you'll make a mistake. But if you want to make it out of this, one day, with your soul intact, follow my advice on this. Question the assignments they give you. We're not blind or robots.
Richards was still looking at the photo of the banker.
Stan, are you trying to tell us this guy isn't guilty?
This guy? Hurley waved his right hand from one side of the table to the other. Hell no! This Nazi piece of shit is guilty as hell. In fact, guys like this piss me off more than the ones who shoot back. This prick lives in his fancy house, takes 2 months off every year, goes to the nicest places, and sleeps like a fucking baby every night. He thinks it's no big deal that he helps these scumbags move their money around. No!
He shook his head.
This is one of those times when I will enjoy pulling the trigger.
Chapter 31 Hurley explained to them that the process wasn't so much about finding the best option as it was eliminating the bad ones. That is, if you had the time to go through all the alternatives. After 2 days together, Hurley made the decision, and they both agreed. Sunday night was the perfect time to make their move, and it would happen at the house. It was located 35 minutes outside of Hamburg, a nice wooded one-acre lot. Rapp was pretty sure Hurley had known from the get-go that this would be the appointed hour, but he wanted some pushback. He wanted Rapp and Richards to tear into his plans and make sure there wasn't a better time to go after Dorfman. For 2 days, that's pretty much all Rapp and Richards did. For Rapp, one of the more enlightening exchanges happened when he asked the salty Hurley, "What about the dogs?"
"Dogs," Hurley said with a devilish smile, "are a double-edged sword. Take this fuck stick, for example."
Hurley pointed to Dorfman's black-and-white photograph. Hurley had taken a black marker and drawn a Hitler mustache on him the night before.
"He's an anal-retentive Nazi prick if I've ever seen one. Wants complete order in his life, so he gets 2 poodles. Why?"
He looked at Rapp and Richards.
"Because they don't shed," Richards answered.
"Exactly. Hans is a neat freak. Wants everything just so. Wakes up the same time Monday through Friday, and Saturdays and Sundays he allows himself 1 extra hour of sack time. He thinks he's too smart for the religion his parents raised him on, so on Sundays, instead of going to church, he reads 2 or 3 newspapers, studies his value lines or whatever it is that a German banker studies, and he takes his dogs for a walk along the river and comes back and takes a nap. He has pot roast, mashed potatoes, and green beans for dinner, watches some crappy TV on the couch, and then lets the dogs out one last time at 10 o'clock, and then it's lights out."
Richards looked at the surveillance info.
"How do you know all these details? I don't see any of it here."
Hurley smiled.
"This isn't my first banker."
Rapp set that thought aside for a second and asked, "But what about the dogs?"
"Oh, yeah, the dogs. The dogs run the show. They need to be let out 4 times a day. Every morning at 7 on the dot, a couple more times during the day, and then 1 more time before they turn in. What does he have to do every time before he lets them out?"
"Turn the alarm off," Rapp answered.
"You two see any alarms at the lake house?"
"Nope," Rapp answered.
"That's because they can make you lazy. You ever see me lock my hounds up?"
"No."
"What good does a dog do if he's locked in his kennel?"
"If he's a guard dog, not much."
"That's right."
Hurley looked at Rapp and said,
"I bet I can guess your next question. You think we should take him while he's walking the dogs by the river?"
The thought occurred to me.
"There's 3 reasons why I would prefer to avoid that option. The first is that it's harder to control things in public setting. Not to say we couldn't do it, we might get lucky and have no witnesses like you did in Istanbul, but that can't be guaranteed. But 2 and 3 are why the park won't work. I need to talk to him, and a public park is hardly the place for the kind of conversation we're going to have."
This came as a complete surprise to Rapp and Richards. Richards asked, "Why?"
"I'll explain it later."
"What's the third reason?" Rapp asked.
"We can't let anyone know he's dead before 9 a.m. Monday."
"Why?" Richards asked.
Rapp answered for him.
"He'll tell us when we're done." The Dorfman file was shredded and burned late Saturday night. By Sunday morning, the ashes were cool enough that they could be scooped into a bag and thrown down the garbage chute. They spent 2 hours that afternoon sanitizing the condo. If they had to come back, they could, but Hurley wanted to avoid doing so if possible. At 8 in the evening, they packed the last of the gear into the trunk of the rented four-door Mercedes sedan and left. Rapp was the wheelman for the evening. Hurley and Richards were going in. It occurred to him that he was being punished for taking the initiative in Istanbul, but what could he say? Someone had to stay with the car. On the drive down the E-22, Hurley went over the plan one last time. Every minute or so, he threw a question at Rapp or Richards, asking them how they would react if this or that thing did not go as planned. Traffic was almost non-existent, so they made it in just 30 minutes. It was a dark, cold, windy night, with temperatures expected to dip near freezing. They were all dressed in jeans and dark coats. Hurley and Richards also had black watch caps on their heads. The neighbor behind Dorfman was a widower with cats but no dogs. The plan was to access his property from her backyard. At 9, they did a final radio check, and then at 9:15, Rapp turned the silver Mercedes onto the winding country road. The dome light was set to off. Rapp downshifted and coasted to a near stop several hundred feet from the widower's house. Richards and Hurley stepped from the slowly moving vehicle, carefully nudged their doors closed, and then disappeared into the trees. Rapp continued. A little less than a minute later, he turned onto Dorfman Street and did a slow drive-by. The house was set back from the street about 75 feet. The front of the house was dark, but faint lights could be seen beyond what they knew was the living room and dining room. Rapp pressed the transmit button on the secure Motorola radio. All's clear up front. Hurley and Richards found their way through the overgrown property of Dorfman's neighbor with relative ease. This was not Hurley's first trip, and he didn't feel the slightest bit guilty for not telling the new recruits. They didn't need to know everything. He had personally put together the surveillance package on Dorfman 8 months earlier. The stuff about the dogs he knew from many years of experience, and as far as bankers being anal retentive, it was a fairly accurate statement. The stuff about Dorfman having left the church that his parents raised him in and being a Nazi prick, he'd learned by keeping an eye on the man for close to 2 years. To run an effective organization, you need money. Hurley and Kennedy had been working overtime trying to map out how these various groups moved their money around the globe, and they had decided Dorfman was the key. In this, the ultimate asymmetric war, where they could not use even a fraction of the might of the United States military, they needed to get creative. If they couldn't openly bomb the terrorist training camps in the Bekaa Valley, then maybe there was another way to hurt them. Hurley and Richards took up position near the back door at 9:30. If they had missed him somehow, Hurley was prepared to cut the phone line and break in. That option presented two problems, however. If he busted the door in, the security system would be tripped, and although an alarm would not be received at the monitoring station, the house's siren would begin to wail and would likely arouse the attention of one of the neighbors. Dorfman also owned a pistol, a shotgun, and a rifle. That Dorfman might react quickly enough to stop the intruders was unlikely, but Hurley didn't like unlikely. The backlight above the kitchen door was turned on at 10:01. Hurley was crouched closest to the door on one knee, and Richards was right behind him. From where he was positioned, Hurley could hear the chimes on the keypad as the digits were entered. The door opened, and the two standard poodles bounded out the door and onto the patio. Hurley had to trust Richards to do his job and stay focused on his. He sprang from his position and put his shoulder into the door before it could be closed. He hit it with enough force that it bounced back and hit an unsuspecting Dorfman in the face. Over his shoulder, he heard the dogs begin to growl. He grabbed the door by the edge and, looking through the glass, came face to face with a stunned Dorfman. The growling had turned to barking, and Hurley resisted the urge to turn around and see how close they were to taking a bite out of his ass. Instead, he pulled the door toward him and then smashed it into Dorfman's face. There was a scramble of nails and paws on the brick patio, and then the welcome sound of compressed air forcing a projectile down a muzzle. One shot, and then a second, each followed by short yelps and then some whimpering. Hurley saw the light switches to his left. There were three of them. He raked his silencer down the wall, knocking all three into the off position and relegating them to semi-darkness. Quickly, he slid through the door, partially closed it, and stuffed the silencer into the shocked and open mouth of Dorfman. Chapter 32. The Mercedes was the same color and model as the one Dorfman drove. Rapp cruised the neighborhood listening to Hurley and Richards with one ear and the police scanner with the other. His German was non-existent, but as Hurley had pointed out, the only thing he needed to listen for was a car being dispatched to Dorfman's address. No car was dispatched, so Rapp pulled the rented Mercedes into the driveway and turned around in the small car park so it was facing out. Hurley reasoned that if any of the neighbors saw the car, they would assume it was Herr Dorfman's. Rapp walked around the side of the house to the backyard and helped Richards carry the second poodle down to the basement. A small dart with red fins was still stuck in the animal's ribcage. It rose and fell with the animal's heavy breathing. Rapp had been tempted to say something to Hurley 2 days earlier when he informed them that they were going to use a tranquilizer gun to take out the dogs, but he kept his mouth shut. He knew that Hurley loved his dogs, but still they were going to kill a man tonight. From a big-picture standpoint, it didn't make a lot of sense to him. Hurley's way was going to take a little more effort and wouldn't silence the dogs as quickly. Hurley knew what Rapp was thinking and noted that the surveillance report said that the dogs usually barked when they were let out of the house, especially at night. It wasn't as if they were storming a terrorist stronghold. It was just a German couple in their 50s. So Rapp kept his tactical opinion to himself. Rapp was now looking down at one of the Germans. Frau Dorfman was blindfolded, gagged, hog-tied, and shivering from fright. He glanced at the knots Richards had made. They were well done. Her wrists and ankles were bound and attached with a length of rope. The only reason Rapp knew anything about them was that his little brother had been fascinated by many things as a child, but knots and magic were the two that became his passion. After their father died, Rapp saw it as his duty to take an interest in Stephen's various hobbies, even if they weren't his. The basement had been finished as a rec room with a bar and a small pool table. Richards had been nice enough to deposit the big German woman on an area rug. Rapp saw a blanket on the back of the couch. He grabbed it and paused. On the wall behind the couch was a poster-sized photo of Dorfman and his two dogs. He was holding a trophy, and the two dogs were licking his face. Rapp covered the woman with the blanket. It was going to be a long night for her, and an even longer morning, but unlike her husband, she would live. Rapp grabbed the phone next to the couch and yanked the cord from the wall. He quickly coiled the cord around the phone as Richards reappeared from the utility room, flashing him the all-clear sign. They were not to speak a word in front of the woman. Rapp climbed the stairs to the first floor, turned off the basement lights, and closed the door. Per the plan, all of the lights had been turned off on the main floor except for the single light over the kitchen sink, as was the Dorfman's habit upon going to bed. Rapp walked through the formal living room, past Richards, who was keeping an eye on the front of the house. The French doors that led to the study were cracked an inch. Rapp pulled his black mask down to cover his face, entered, and closed the door behind him. Dorfman was on the floor in his light blue pajamas. His comb-over hair was all askew and his nose was bleeding. A leather reading chair had been tossed to the side and the rug pulled back to reveal a floor safe. Dorfman looked up at Rapp with tears in his eyes. Again, Rapp didn't understand German beyond 100-odd words, but he could tell the whimpering idiot was asking about his dogs and not his wife. Rapp looked around the office and counted no fewer than 10 photos of his dogs. There was one 5x7 of the wife and two kids that had to be 15 years old. Rapp counted 7 trophies and a dozen-plus ribbons. Dorfman was still desperately asking about his Hunde. Rapp raised his silenced Beretta and said, "Shut up." Hurley squatted down on his haunches and tapped the dial of the safe with the tip of his silencer. His German was perfect. He ordered Dorfman to open the safe. Dorfman closed his eyes and shook his head. They spoke for another 20 seconds, and still he refused. Hurley looked up at Rapp and said, "Go get his wife." Rapp shook his head. Hurley frowned. "Let me take a shot at this. What do you say I grab one of your dogs and put a bullet in his head?" Rapp saw the flicker of recognition in the banker's eyes. "That's right, you idiot. I'm going to get one of your dogs and bring him up here." Rapp reached into his coat and pulled out a tactical knife. He bent over and stuck the tip in front of Dorfman's face. "I'll do you one better. I'm going to lay your Hund at your feet, and then I'm going to cut out one of his eyes and force-feed it to you." "Nein! Nein!" Dorfman looked truly frightened. "If you don't open the safe, I'm going to start with your pooch's eyes, and then his tongue, and then his nose, and then his ears, and if you still haven't opened it by then, I'm going to shove all of it down your throat, and then I'll start in on the second dog, and if that doesn't get you to do it, then I'll start in on you.
Dorfman closed his eyes as tight as he could, and shook his head in defiance. Patiently waiting for Dorfman to decide to open the safe wasn't in the cards. Rapp flipped the knife up in the air and caught it, reversing his hold. He then slammed the tip of it down into Dorfman's thigh. The banker's entire body went rigid with pain, and he opened his mouth to scream. Hurley gave him a quick backhanded chop to the throat, successfully choking off the shriek of agony. 10 seconds passed before Dorfman was calm enough to talk to.
"Last chance. Open the safe," Rapp said.
Dorfman was now slobbering, muttering something and shaking his head.
"Fine," Rapp said as he moved to the door. "We'll do it your way."
Rapp went back to the basement, turned on the light, and stood over the two poodles and the wife. He wasn't sure which one to grab, so he picked the one on the left. Rapp cradled it in his arms and went back to the office. Richards opened the door for him. Rapp gently laid the pooch at his master's feet. The sight of his precious dog in the arms of the masked maniac sent Dorfman into a near apoplectic state. Hurley slapped him hard and once again pointed at the safe. At least this time Dorfman didn't shake his head. Rapp retrieved his knife and held the tip in front of the dog's face. "Left eye or right eye, you choose." Dorfman was now bawling like a child, reaching out for his dog. Rapp wasn't sure he had the stomach for this, but what the hell else were they going to do? He glanced at Hurley, whose dark eyes, alert with uncertainty framed by his ski mask, seemed to be pleading with him to stop. Rapp got the impression that Hurley would rather torture the banker than harm the dog. Rapp cradled the dog's head in his arms and slowly started moving the blade toward the poodle's left eye. He was within a centimeter of piercing the outer layer when Dorfman finally relented. He literally threw himself onto the safe and began spinning the dial. Rapp waited until he entered the correct combination and then released the dog. Dorfman crawled to his dog and pulled him in, kissing him on the snout and the top of his head. "What the fuck?" Rapp muttered to himself and then asked Dorfman, "You care more about that damn dog than you do your wife, don't you?" Dorfman either didn't hear him or chose to ignore the question. Rapp looked at Hurley, who was emptying the contents of the safe.
"I told you," Hurley said as he pulled out three objects and held them up for Rapp to see. "An SS dagger and insignia. Nazi prick."
"A poodle-loving Nazi who helps terrorists. Great." Rapp started to raise his gun but stopped.
"Is it in there?"
Hurley held up some files, computer disks, and an external hard drive.
"I think so."
He leafed through the files quickly.
"Yep, it's all here. Jackpot."
"Dorfman," Rapp said as he pointed his gun at the banker's head. "I bet if those damn terrorists were running around killing dogs, you would have thought twice about helping them."
"Please," Dorfman said. "I'm just a businessman."
"Who helps terrorists move their money around so they can target and kill innocent civilians?"
"I knew nothing of such things."
"You're a liar."
"That's for certain,"
Hurley said as he stood with the bag full of files and disks. He placed the rug back over the closed safe, and while moving the chair back, said,
"You have their names, their accounts."
Hurley shook the bag. "You knew exactly who you were dealing with."
"I was doing my job for the bank."
"Like a good Nazi." Hurley gave him a big smile and pointed the Beretta at Dorfman's head.
"And I'm only doing my job."
Hurley squeezed the trigger and sent a single bullet into Dorfman's brain. The man fell back against the hardwood floor with a thump that was louder than the gunshot. A puddle of blood began to seep out in all directions. Hurley looked at Rapp and said,
"Let's get the fuck out of here. We need to be in Zurich by sunrise."
"What's in Zurich?"
"Same thing that's always in Zurich. Money and assholes."
Chapter 33. Moscow, Russia. Ivanov carefully lowered himself into his chair at SVR headquarters in the Yasenovo district of Moscow. Last night had been a wild one. He had closed a very lucrative business deal. A group of foreign investors were looking to pick up some natural gas contracts and were willing to give Ivanov a 7-figure retainer and a nice piece of the action if he could guarantee the acquisition. Now all Ivanov had to do was talk some sense into one of his countrymen who had already made a nice profit on the fields. And if he couldn't talk some sense into him, he would have Svietz and a crew of his loyal officers pay the men a call and make him an offer he couldn't refuse. Ivanov smiled as he thought of his favorite movie, The Godfather.
He would very much like to meet Francis Ford Coppola someday. The man had captured the essence of power perfectly. That was what Russia was all about in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. The two systems were not, at the end of the day, all that different from each other. Both were corrupt to the core, and both systems served to line the pockets of the powerful. Under the old Soviet system, the inefficiencies were ridiculous. People who had no business holding a position of authority did so often, and their inability to make smart decisions doomed the communist experiment from the start. There was no motivation for the talented to rise to the top. In fact, it could be said that there was the opposite motivation. If you dared criticize the foolish systems put into place by some imbecile who held a post because he was the brother-in-law of an important official, you were more likely than not to get your meager pay cut. Everyone wallowed in that sub-average world except the lucky few. Today, things were dynamic. Money was to be made everywhere, and lots of it. Startup companies were popping up at an incredible rate, and foreign investors were lining up to get into the game. The game, though, was a treacherous one. Remnants of the Soviet system were still in place, sucking off the system and causing a huge drain on the efficiency of the new economy. And then there were the corrupt courts, police, and security services. It was the Godfather, the Wild West, and 1920s gangster America all rolled into one. These bankers and businessmen could either wallow in that inefficiency and red tape for months, costing them valuable time and money, or they could come to Ivanov, and he could make their problems go away. Unlike the army of Jew lawyers who had descended on the city who claimed they knew what they were doing, Ivanov could actually follow through on those claims and deliver real results to his new partners. And they were always partners. Depending on the deal, Ivanov would sometimes lower his fee, but never his percentage. The 10% ownership stake was non-negotiable. He wasn't alone in this. And that was yet another parallel to the Academy Award-winning movie. There were others in Moscow and across the vast country who were doing the same thing, although, Ivanov would argue, not as well. Ivanov was not shy about touting the importance of his role in this brave new world, and defended it as a natural extension of his state security job. Someone needed to keep track of all these foreign investors and make sure they weren't stealing the motherland's natural resources. After all, he was far more deserving of the profits than some 25-year-old business school graduate. At least, that was what he told himself. Fietz entered the office looking far too rested and handsome, which had the effect of worsening Ivanov's mood. "Good morning, sir." Fietz remained standing. He knew better than to take a seat unless he was ordered. "Get me some water," Ivanov grumbled. While Fietz poured a glass, he asked, "You look like you stayed out all night. Would you like some aspirin as well?" "Yes." He snapped his long, tanned fingers to spur his assistant to move faster. He could feel his headache passing from one temple to the other, and then swinging back, as if he were being scanned by an irritating beam. He downed the three pills and the water. For a split second, he thought of adding vodka. It would definitely help with the headache, but it was too early to surrender. Fietz and the new breed would take it as a sign of weakness. "I heard you got them to agree in principle to the partnership."
"Yes," Ivanov moaned.
"Would you like me to have Maxim bring the contracts over?"
"Yes, and so, I want to know when you are leaving for Beirut and who you're bringing with you."
"Tomorrow, and I'm bringing Alexei and Ivan."
Ivanov thought about that. Alexei and Ivan were two of his best. Former Spetsnaz, they'd fought with valor and distinction in Afghanistan, but had gotten in trouble when their regiment's political officer had turned up with his throat cut one morning. They had more than likely done it. Political officers were notorious for being assholes, and in those final days of the USSR, more than a few of them simply disappeared. Ivanov was always looking for men who were good with their hands, and these two were better than good.
"Why Alexei and Ivan?"
"Because they're from Georgia, and they look like they could be Lebanese."
That was true, but Ivanov didn't like having his two best gunmen leaving his side. In Moscow these days, the only thing you could count on was that sooner or later someone would try to take you out. It was just like the American mobsters. The vision of Sonny Corleone being mercilessly gunned down at the toll booth,
betrayed by his own brother-in-law, the snake sent chills down Ivanov's back. He shuddered and then decided he would keep Alexei and Ivanov close. They were his Lukobrasi times, too. Take Oleg and Yakov. Svietz frowned.
Why can't you just follow my orders?
In a calm voice, Svietz said,
When have I once failed to follow your orders?
You know what I mean, your face.
I am in no mood for it this morning.
Ivanov lowered his big head into his hands and groaned.
I might as well go by myself. That is a brilliant idea. Travel to the kidnapping capital of the Mediterranean by yourself so they can snatch you off the street and hold you for ransom. Brilliant! Is it my fault that you stay out drinking and screwing until sunrise? Don't start. I am half your age and I can't keep up with you. You are half my size, too, so we're even. You need to slow down or there will be problems.
Ivanov's head snapped up.
Is that a threat?
No, Svietz said, shaking his head with a pathetic disappointment in his boss. Why must my loyalty always be questioned?
I am talking about your health. You need to take some time off. Go someplace warm, maybe come to Beirut with me. Beirut is a hellhole. It was once a great place, not anymore, you will see. I heard it's coming back.
Ah! Ivanov laughed. Not the part where you'll be going. The famous Green Line looks like Leningrad in 1941. It's a bombed-out shell. Our friends are trying to reconstitute it before the Christians take it over. It is not a nice place. Before Svietz could respond, there was a knock on the office door. It was Pavel Sokol, one of Ivanov's deputies, who worked exclusively on state security financial matters. And if his ghostly complexion was any hint, he was not here to bring glad tidings.
Sir, Sokol's voice cracked a touch. He did that when he was afraid it was going to upset Ivanov. We have a problem.
What kind of problem, goddammit?
Sokol started to explain and then stopped and then started again when he realized there was no good way to spin the bad news.
We have certain accounts that we use to move money overseas. For our various activities, that is.
I'm not an idiot, Sokol. We have accounts all over the place. Which ones are you talking about?
The ones in Zurich. Specifically the ones, he glanced at his notes, at SBC.
He closed the file and looked at his boss. Ivanov glared at the pasty man. They had 138 accounts with the Swiss bank corporation.
Which accounts, damn it?
Sokol opened the file again. Rather than trying to read the numbers, which even he didn't understand, he reached across the desk and handed the paper to his boss. Ivanov looked down at the list of accounts. There were six, and he was intimately familiar with whom they belonged to.
What am I supposed to learn from this? There's nothing. Just account numbers.
Actually, sir,
Sokol pointed nervously at the sheet.
On the far side, those are the balances of each account.
Ivanov's eyes nearly popped out of his head.
This says these accounts are empty.
That's right, sir.
How?
Ivanov yelled as he jumped to his feet.
Swiss Interbank Clearing executed the order at 9:01 Zurich time this morning. The money was emptied out of these accounts electronically.
I know how it works, you fucking moron. Where did it go?
We don't know, sir.
Ivanov made a fist, as if he might come over the desk and bash his deputy over the head.
We'll find out.
We can't,
Sokol said, fearing for his life. Once the money is gone, it is gone. There is no way to trace it. Swiss banking laws...
Shut up, you fool! Ivanov yelled. I am well aware of Swiss banking laws, and I don't give a shit. You'd better find a way around them, or you are going to be either dead or looking for a job.
Sokol bowed and left, without saying another word. The vodka was on the sidebar. It was always on the sidebar, five different kinds. Ivanov could barely see, his head hurt so much, and he really didn't care which bottle he was grabbing. Vodka was vodka at this point. He poured four fingers into a tall glass. Sloshing a bit over the side, he took a huge gulp, clenched his teeth, and let the clean, clear liquid slide down his throat.
No one was supposed to know about those accounts, let alone have the ability to drain them of their funds. This could seriously jeopardize his standing within not just the security service, but the entire government as well.